Buonasera, oggi abbiamo una importante sessione della Summer School dedicata sempre alla tematica. Io ora qua il programma in inglese, ma me lo ricordo dato che ci abbiamo lavorato molto su sviluppi e prospettive in materia di concorrenza e di mercato. Il primo dei relatori di oggi è il professor Maher Dabba della Queen Mary University of London, il quale oltre a essere un caro amico è anche un importantissimo esperto in materia di diritto della concorrenza. In particolare il professor Dabba è fra l'altro direttore del centro interdisciplinare per la Competition Law and Policy della Queen Mary University. È molto giovane, ma come sapete in Inghilterra sono molto aperte, la società inglese è molto aperta anche nei confronti dei giovani, quindi nonostante la giovanissima età già ricopre questo incarico accademico molto importante, ed è specializzato in particolare sulla dimensione globale della politica di concorrenza. Diciamo, è uno dei massimi esperti al mondo in questo settore. Ha pubblicato diverse monografie su questo problema, sulla internazionalizzazione della politica di concorrenza, tutte presso l'importante casa editrice Cambridge University Press. Fra l'altro, ancora nonostante la giovane età, è anche autore di un manuale di UK Competition Law, diritto della concorrenza europeo e inglese, e svolge anche l'attività di avvocato, di barrister, sempre a Londra. Il professor Dabba vi parlerà, il titolo è La dimensione internazionale della politica di concorrenza. Comunque, dato che stamattina abbiamo avuto un'introduzione molto interessante e stimolante del professor Monti, incentrata però più sugli aspetti generali, soprattutto di carattere economico, in materia di concorrenza, il professor Dabba introdurrà preliminarmente la politica di concorrenza dal punto di vista generale e soprattutto con un focus sugli aspetti giuridici. Quindi dalla dimensione generale economica oggi scendiamo con la relazione del professor Dabba ad analizzare gli aspetti più tecnici, gli aspetti di carattere prettamente giuridico. Io non voglio rubare altro tempo a Maher Dabba, che ringrazio tantissimo per aver accettato di partecipare a questa iniziativa nonostante i innumerevoli impegni. Fra l'altro è stata per me un'occasione per rivederlo, l'ultima volta ci siamo visti a Mosca qualche anno fa, per poterci rivedere qua nella città in cui lavoro. Grazie, thank you Maher, and you have the floor.
Thank you Marco. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First, I have to say, unfortunately, to my greatest regret, I do not speak Italian. So I don't understand quite what Professor Gestry said. I hope he said good things. I really would like to congratulate the organizers and Professor Gestry in particular on putting together this wonderful event on Europe of Ideas. Really, if you think about it, Europe only develops, and any progress within any field in the European Union can only be made when ideas themselves are developed and advanced. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to contribute to such a fascinating debate. Perhaps there has been no more important field within which European ideas have been more important and more influential than the field of competition law itself, whether within the EC or internationally. Within the European community, competition law plays a hugely important role, a key role to bring about very important benefits for us as citizens. If you think about it, lower prices, better quality of products, and obviously more choice. Internationally, EC competition law regime also plays a very important role. And over the years, a very impressive international dimension has come to be developed to the whole interpretation, application, and enforcement of the EC rules on competition. developing this international dimension to EC competition law has in itself been a European idea to, first of all, promote the single market and strengthen the community. Secondly, to turn EC competition law regime into a dominant regime on world stage, which other countries can consult for lessons and experience. And finally, to help internationalize competition law as a whole. Now, when one talks about the international dimension of competition law, there is one key question arises, which is this. Is competition law really international? Well, most people would agree that whether the question or whether competition law is really international or not can be answered in two ways, yes and no. It's a yes because if you look around the world, there are about 100 countries that have adopted some form of competition law, and that makes competition law arguably an international form of law. It's a no, on the other hand, because believe it or not, the vast majority of people around the world haven't heard about competition law at all. I would quantify this majority very conservatively at about 70%. And so those of us who have heard about competition law or even specialize in it are very much in the minority. In many parts of the world, competition law simply is unknown and is simply totally misunderstood. In fairness, however, competition law or public awareness of competition law has been increasing, and I would say for a number of reasons. First, because nowadays many countries have come to adopt competition law, different countries, developing American, European, African, Asian. Secondly, many competition authorities around the world have been engaged in vigorous competition enforcement to eradicate all types of anti-competitive practices and to protect their consumers. And of course, thirdly, there have been very serious efforts made towards educating the public on how competition actually benefits them directly. This is what we call competition advocacy. But the increase in the awareness of public of competition law globally hasn't been the result of local developments. I would say from my experience that some competition law developments in foreign regimes have done a great deal more to enhance public awareness in certain countries than the work of local competition authorities. If you look at the EC regime, you will find that it accounts for the lion's share behind the truth or standing behind this statement itself. Take where I come from originally, a very small Middle Eastern village. I take my village, my original village that is, to represent the entire region, the Middle East. 90%, possibly even 95% of my village haven't heard about our national competition law or the existence of our national competition authority, which is located something like 120 miles away. Yet 60% of my village have heard about the decision of the European Court of First Instance in the case of Microsoft, which was delivered in Luxembourg last September, which is some 1,900 miles away. I can't really tell you how amazed I was during a recent visit to the region when a 12-year-old boy was able to discuss the Microsoft situation with me and the issue of Windows and Media Player. He said he read about it on the internet. Indeed, if I were to speak my mind very freely, I would say that the Microsoft decision in particular, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, has had such a huge global impact vibrating to the smallest villages around the world. Take when Microsoft wanted to contest the fine that was imposed by the Commission. A Middle Eastern daily newspaper, a very small Middle Eastern daily newspaper, reported on this story 2 days before even the Financial Times, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, actually seized on this very important development. So this simple yet powerful example really illustrates the kind of influence that EC competition law has come to occupy internationally. It also demonstrates very clearly that EC competition law regime does have an important international dimension, and that what happens in Europe in terms of competition law is eye-catching all over the world. And so the key question that we have to ask is this: how has this international dimension come to be built within the European community? Well, in a variety of ways, indeed in three important ways. Through a unilateral strategy, as the slide shows you, the doctrine of extraterritoriality, through bilateralism, i.e. bilateral cooperation, and finally, through a multilateral approach. I will look at all of these ways individually, starting first of all with the unilateral strategy, extraterritoriality. Competition law in Europe has primarily been about protecting the process of competition, protecting consumers, bringing to them very key benefits, and of course, promoting the single market objective. In setting out to achieve all of these goals, the European Commission, which is the main enforcement body in the European community, has applied the rules and has sought to punish all types of anti-competitive situations, regardless of the nationality or place of incorporation of the firms concerned. Meaning, in the same way the European Commission has sought to apply the competition rules to deal with EC, the behavior conduct transactions of EC-based firms, it has also relied on an extraterritorial approach to the rules in order to address situations involving non-EC firms in this case, in order to ensure effectively that the behavior of such firms will be regulated and will be controlled. Hence, the ability of the European Commission, if you think about it, to punish the practices of Microsoft, a non-EC firm, and to block the merger between US firms, General Electric and Honeywell International, the big merger case in 2001. The doctrine of extraterritoriality simply means this, that the European Commission, like many competition authorities around the world, is able to apply local rules to deal with foreign situations. Now, the legal basis for this doctrine of extraterritoriality is in public international law itself. Under public international law, states have the right to assert jurisdiction over situations, even if they are foreign situations, which may harm their interest, the interest of their citizens, or threaten their national security. If you translate this into competition law terms, it means this, that a competition authority will be able to apply its local competition rules to situations, albeit being or although being foreign ones, where such situations produce adverse effects on competition inside the local markets, or the situation one way or another is implemented in the jurisdiction concerned. This is what is called the doctrine of effects and the doctrine of implementation in the field of competition law. Now, this doctrine of extraterritoriality has been a very important tool in widening the net of local competition rules to ensure simply that foreign anti-competitive situations will be controlled. So in other words, it means that you will be able to control and deal with situations which may be much wider than the national territory or the national borders themselves. Now, we all agree, possibly, that this extraterritorial approach may be problematic, it may be controversial. For example, the United States may consider it to be controversial, objectionable, if the European Commission were to block a merger between two US firms, meaning this is an infringement of my own sovereignty, and that is no doubt a valid claim. It has to be taken seriously. At the other end of the spectrum, however, it has to be accepted that there are situations in which if you do not apply local competition rules extraterritorially, it means that certain practices will simply go unpunished. That means there will be international cartels, there will be an abuse of dominance on the part of multinational firms, there may be transnational mergers, all of them giving rise to serious competition problems, which will simply go unpunished if you do not apply the rules extraterritorially. And the European Commission has applied EC competition law extraterritorially out of one basic objective, which is to ensure that the process of competition and the interest of consumers in the EC are not harmed, are not hindered, as well as, of course, having to be promoted in a very positive way. The second way in which the international dimension to EC competition has been built has been through reliance on the mechanism of bilateralism. And this really includes two different strands. The first is bilateral cooperation that is competition-focused, and that involves the European Commission on the one hand and other competition authorities. Famous examples here include things like the 1991 EC-US cooperation agreement, as well as the 1998 cooperation agreement between the Commission, between the EC and the US. These are competition specific type of cooperation. They involve pretty much the European Commission on the one hand and US competition authorities on the other, mainly or namely, in this case, the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. The second strand in which bilateral cooperation has been built has been through bilateral links and ties with third countries or even blocks of countries that have a competition component. So this includes things like free trade agreements, association agreements, partnership and cooperation agreements, even links that the Commission has with the Mediterranean region, such as the Euromed agreement, the neighborhood agreement. But bilateral cooperation in the field of competition law has very important benefits, which include the following, that when you have a bilateral cooperation mechanism, the effectiveness of competition enforcement can be enhanced, the efficiency of your own competition investigations can be enhanced. Also, you can have an avoidance of jurisdictional conflicts, as well as, of course, relief for business firms themselves. All of the benefits that you can see listed on the slide there. But there is also one very important benefit flowing from bilateral cooperation, and that is convergence between different rules and between different systems. Convergence means that essentially situations of similarities will be enhanced, similar standards will be used in different regimes or in the two regimes concerned. Now, we don't necessarily mean here that the rules in the different regimes have to have identical rules. No. Convergence can also happen at the analytical level, the way you analyze cases, the way you apply the rules, and that in practice many times is extremely important. Now, if you look at the European Commission has always placed very important emphasis on its bilateral cooperation. If you look, for example, at the relationship it has with US competition authorities, you will find that always the Commission emphasized bilateral cooperation because, first of all, you're talking about the US and EC regimes being the most important competition regimes in the world. And secondly, many cases actually fall within the concurrent jurisdiction of both the EC and the US. So clearly, therefore, building a positive mechanism for cooperation has been very important for both the Commission and US competition authorities, but also for business firms themselves. Business firms are always anxious when they have their transactions, behavior, conduct being regulated or reviewed by different competition authorities. Why? Because there can be conflicting outcomes. There can be higher costs for them in terms of time and money. And of course, business firms are always keen to avoid this. At the same time, bilateralism has, or bilateral cooperation has enabled the Commission to do one thing that is strategically, psychologically, is very important, and that is to spread EC competition law around the world. If you look at all over the world, you will find that many countries have rules that are based and modeled on EC competition law. Bilateralism has been absolutely key here, because whether you look at association agreements with many Central and Eastern European countries, those countries that came to join the EC, for example, or with the Russian Federation, or with the Euromed region, for example, through all of these agreements, you will find competition law featuring very, very prominently. And all of these agreements pretty much contain rules that are modeled on EC competition law. In particular, Article 81, which deals with collusion between firms, and Article 82, which deals with situations of abuse of dominance. Now, if you look at what has been happening with these agreements, you will notice the following, that first, when the agreement is concluded, it will contain competition provisions modeled on EC competition law. And then when the agreement is implemented, the other party will then either introduce competition rules that are compatible with the agreement, or it will change its existing rules to actually meet or be compatible with those in the agreement. What's the outcome here? The outcome is that the other party, the other country concerned, will end up adopting competition rules that are simply modeled indirectly on those of EC competition law. Now, in practice, in political terms, call it what you will, this is hugely important, especially during those times when there is very healthy, what I call healthy rivalry between Europe and America, having so many countries around the world adopting competition rules based on EC competition law is a very important victory for the European community and for the Commission in particular. Take the example of many Central and Eastern European nations before they came to accede to the community. Throughout the 1990s, when they were economies in transition, there was a very important race between the United States and Europe to the doorstep of these countries. Basically, each wanted to have greater influence over these countries. At the end, as we all know, the Commission ended up being victorious here, because all of these countries now, if you look at them, with no exception, have competition rules based on those of the European community. How did that happen? Because simply the European Commission set it as a condition that if you want to exceed the community, you need to have competition rules. Not only that, your competition rules will have to be based on those of the European community. And note the interesting thing here is that legally, it wasn't crucial for those countries to have competition rules modeled on the EC system to have a successful competition law regime. But for these particular reasons, no doubt they had to have it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have fulfilled the accession criteria in that case. So to put the point really differently and sum it up in relation to bilateral cooperation has enabled the European Commission to effectively spread EC competition law around the world. And note here, there was a reference in the morning discussion to how Europe has influenced America in the field of competition law. Even in relation to America and the United States, which has competition law since 1890, there has been a European influence. I was hoping to see an answer in the morning session, which is this. If you look at some cases in practice, the way they are decided in America, they actually employ and use EC-based concepts, although the laws in America do not mention this. For example, the concept of dominance. If you look at some merger cases, there's one merger case that I happen to know very closely that involved the two companies, probably you've heard about them, Office Depot and Staples. Office Depot wanted to acquire Staples. The US Federal Trade Commission said no to the merger, because it felt that the merger was going to create a dominant entity. Yet, if you look at the relevant rules in the United States, there is no reference to dominance at all. So that's an easy standard that has been employed and used in the U.S. itself. And so in the U.S., there has been an EC influence, and also beyond in relation to other situations, the EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, and the EEA, the European Economic Area or Association. If you look at countries like Norway, Iceland, even Switzerland, which is not part of the EEA, you will find that all of them tell you, we have been inspired by the European rules on competition, and all of them have rules that are based on EC competition rule. The final strand I would like to look at is that of multilateralism. And I think the interesting point here is this. It is most remarkable that the European Commission, despite being the only effective supranational competition authority in the world, has always and consistently pushed for multilateral solutions in the field. Even as early as 1996, when the whole WTO project came to fruition, the European Commission pushed for developing a competition agenda within the WTO, as we can see this from the creation of the Singapore Group in 1996 to study the relationship between trade and competition. Now, as we all know, little progress has come to be made over the years with regard to developing a competition mandate within the WTO. And as things stand at present, the entire idea is frozen. It is put on hold. Nonetheless, this hasn't stopped the European Commission from believing one thing, and that is multilateralism is the way forward to deal with many international competition problems. A notable example here has been the ICN, the International Competition Network. If you look at the ICN, it's a most interesting project. It's a virtual network that brings together different competition authorities around the world, and that has an interesting mechanism called soft law convergence. It means that essentially convergence between different competition law regimes will be achieved without legally binding obligations being introduced on competition authorities, and with competition authorities voluntarily adopting those standards. A highly successful idea, and the European Commission has always played a key role in the creation of the ICN. It was one of the three founding organizations or competition authorities of the ICN with the two US competition authorities. And the ICN has been a phenomenal success. And in my view, the European Commission can take a particular pride in that respect. Beyond the ICN, the European Commission has made important contributions to the competition debate within UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, within the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and it has championed a very important cause, and that is to offer technical assistance to many competition authorities around the world, especially young competition authorities, in order to help them advance their experience in the field. I think it is appropriate at this time to offer some reflections on what we have said. I think there is no doubt that as far as developing an international dimension to competition law, the European community and the European Commission has had a success story. And one can say one key pillar in this success story has been the fact that the EC regime itself is a supranational regime, and the European Commission itself is a supranational competition authority. What does that mean? It means that you can say that the international dimension actually is very much inherent in the actual characteristics of EC competition law regime and the characteristics of the European Commission as a competition authority. However, in my view, one must not overlook a very important factor here, which is the development of a very important intrinsic dimension over the years, an internal success, the success that the European Commission has had at home. It's always easy to overlook the fact that the European community is actually made of two different levels, the community level and the national level. And for many years, there has been a very heated debate on how much competence should be enjoyed at the higher community level. As we know, the transfer of jurisdiction, the limitation of sovereignty, the doctrine of supremacy, call it, etc., any other term that you want. Now, the field of competition law has always been one of those vital areas in which the European Commission has come to build its competence and its legitimacy as a supranational competition authority and as an effective authority operating within an effective regime that has a community-wide application. And for many years, there was a centralization in the system, meaning the European Commission was very much at the center. It had, in relation to many aspects, an exclusive monopoly. It meant that certain types of enforcements couldn't be handled by national competition authorities or national courts, but rather only by the Commission itself. Now, this old system of centralization has now been replaced by a new, modern, modernized system, decentralization, in other words, brought as a result of Regulation 1/2003. It means that nowadays we have a system of shared competences. The European Commission and national competition authorities together making up what is called the ECN, the European Competition Network, and together having a shared responsibility in the enforcement of Articles 81 and 82. Now, this is a development of an enormous significance and importance. Why? Because effectively it has enabled the Commission to consolidate its work, to focus on the enforcement in relation to practices that are extremely harmful, such as international cartels, serious abuses of dominance. All of these cases, believe it or not, without exception, have a strong international dimension. So what does that mean? It means that what happened at home has had a direct positive impact on developing an international dimension and furthering this international dimension over the years. And, you know, we might have a big debate over this, but in my view, this reflects a very basic philosophy in life, which is this: we are always stronger outside and around us when we are stronger within. And the European Commission, the European Community Competition Law regime, believe me, are no exception in this regard. And perhaps what I'm presenting here to you is a European idea. So thanks very much for listening, and I'll pass over.